This is Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee.
I figured, well, you got to be real smart about this, and you know, wait for him to make his move, because, so that you can, you know, make it harder that same direction, so that he can't have, doesn't have time to, you know, think about it and be able to, you know, react to that. So, I figured, you know, high, low, or over top of him, I was going to do whatever it took to win the race.
Here's the finish. Sam Hornish Jr. makes the pass. He'll win it. Sam Hornish Jr. goes to the inside of Marco Andretti and wins it in the final 100 yards.
You know, I came off there hoping that we were going to win the race, but, you know, not sure if we were going to have enough.
Sam Hornish Jr. has won the 90th Indianapolis 500 in an incredible finish.
You know, I couldn't believe that, you know, we, you know, when we hit the stripe or the yard of bricks, that that I was over, you know, all the way past him and then some, but pretty neat deal.
And until that checkered flag's unfurled, it's the greatest, greatest, greatest.
Trackside, 1070 The Fan, WFNI, Indianapolis. Thanks for joining us tonight as we continue to get set for the 96th running of the Indianapolis 500. That was the open to the radio broadcast in 2007, recapping one that I think has to be on the short list for greatest 500s ever, the 2006 finish where Hornish passed Marco Andretti down the main straightaway to win it. My name is Kevin Lee. Thad Van Dievender is our studio producer. Kurt Cavan from the Indianapolis Star is here tonight. We are in split locations. Kurt, I'm on assignment tonight, covering Little League Baseball for the radio station. It's very important that we have this covered tonight, so I will be here with updates if needed, which they will not be needed, and you will slide over and anchor things tonight, so I will be here at your call this evening. A couple of things I do want to mention before I turn it over. I need to thank Paul Dalby, Field of 33, on Twitter and from morefrontwing.com. He won some sort of a contest on Twitter to get a group in the Graham Rahal Foundation golf outing today. So that's how we weaseled our way into golf today and made up for it by buying a lot of mulligans to help donate to what Graham and his girlfriend Lake and Kurtz have done, and they did a great job. It was a fantastic outing today. Great day for golf. Also played with Ryan and Patrick Gavigan, so enjoyed playing with those guys. And shockingly, it's the first time I've played this season. I'm not sure how I haven't been playing three times a week, because I've not had anything to do this spring. But that was fun. Playing at the Brickyard is always good. And here's our tease for the Burger Bash. You too could play golf with us coming up at the Brickyard. Is that correct?
I think so. That's it's going to be based off your busy schedule. I mean, you've got baseball and some baseball games that you actually will probably work, and Pacers postseason if it continues, and Colts preseason. I mean, you're just all over the place. You are the trouble spot with scheduling.
It is a bit challenging, and that's why I play about six times a year. I was almost decent before the kids were born and before I had four jobs, and I only had two or three jobs. But now we'll find time in the summer. It starts to slow down here in just a little bit with mostly just weekend work. So looking forward to that, looking forward to the Carb Night Burger Bash, and still a lot of different storylines to talk about this week as we get set for the 500.
Let's start with any gossip, any discussion at the golf tournament, and how well did you hit them?
I hit them like someone who has not played since September.
I bet.
Yes. I actually played okay. And the good thing about not playing very often, when I used to play a lot, I'd get mad and upset, and I don't do that anymore. And I had heard this before, but I didn't actually apply it until recently when I play very rarely. But I forget who the pro golfer was, but I'm sure many pro golfers have said this. When they play in one of these celebrity pro-ams with a pro golfer and their guy who's a 12 handicap or a 16 handicap or whatever, you know, throws his club after something, and the pro golfer will say, son, you're not good enough to get mad. Just accept it and have fun. And that's pretty much the way I've moved at this point. So as long as I get it up in the air and hit it in the general direction of the hole, I'm okay with it. If I start playing more, then maybe I'll start to have greater expectations. But it was fun. I know James Jakes was there, who's a very good golfer, I'm pretty sure, although I've never seen him play. But I know he plays several times a week in the off season and still tries to play about once a week during the season. I think he belongs to Islesworth Tigers Club down in Orlando, or at least what used to be Tigers Club. I have no idea if it still is. And Ed Carpenter was there as well, along with Graham. Bob Rahal was there. And then all the people from Fuzzies were there. Good stuff. They had a lot of sponsors, and I think they raised a lot of money, which is the most important thing.
You know, we can hear balls and strikes called, so this is a really live on the scene. If you could do this with racetracks, we'd really be in business with you.
We have done it from racetracks.
That's true. Well, that's
I'm
true.
I'm in the bleachers in dead center field, and I have moved away to annoy as few people as possible. So I'm in a little area by myself, although when we started, the center fielder did turn around, so I had to move back a few more steps.
Let me give you a kind of a preview of where we're going tonight. We're going to talk probably for, I don't know, the first segment at least, and then go through the second segment with you. Then at 7:30, Doug Bowles is going to join us to talk a little bit, Dan Weldon, and how the car was moved into the museum and what the plans are for the weekend. We've talked about it, but I think he and I will talk about it at a personal level, given that we both spent a lot of time with Dan. I think that will be interesting. And then for the final segment, the goal is I've got two engineers kind of on the making sure that they get their PR contacts lined up so that PR people know that they're doing media work. And so hopefully one of those two will come on the show to talk about just the changes that have been made to the Dallara chassis, a little bit of a kind of a minor change now to the under tray so that the lifting problem that we saw, and I'm not, I guess I've been reluctant to call it a problem. Certainly IndyCar and Dallara would like to address it. I still say that the two cars, Charlie Kimball and Ed Carpenter, that got off the ground, were probably going to get off the ground even if these changes were made. Maybe not to the level, but I would expect when you go in, as we talked about last night, if you go into a corner and hit with the left front the way they did, you're going to have some lift in the back corner opposite. I just don't see how it's going to change that dramatically. These changes, basically, you've got some adjustments, and I think the engineers will help us explain those things. So that's kind of where we stand tonight. Of course, following our show at 8 o'clock, the talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. He wanders in early, and we talked about some things. By the way, I don't know that you had a chance to listen last night because you were up to your ears in Pacer misery. But last night, Donald went through, had you noticed that there is such a representation of Formula One drivers, you know, in terms of career starts in this field? Donald went back and really he believes that 1993 actually had more Formula One drivers or guys who had Formula One starts. And I thought that was an interesting conversation. You can go back to the podcast at 1070thefan.com if you'd like to hear that segment. But Donald has spent a little time with this, and of course he goes back to 93, which had four Formula One world champions in it, Nigel Mansell and Mario Andretti, Nelson Piquet, and now I'm drawing a blank on the fourth one, I'm sure is
Emerson Fittipaldi.
Emerson Fittipaldi, of course, was on his way to winning a second Indy 500 that year. But it also...
And Cheever would have been in that race.
Yep. I think he counted 11, maybe, or between 8 and 11.
Oh, wow.
I think it was 8 now that I say that. But just a very high number of drivers who were in that race, and the totals are pretty significant. This one, of course, has Takuma Sato as well, and Justin Wilson. But an interesting kind of discussion, so... I know you go back and listen to podcasts while you're running down the road getting ready for next year's mini marathon. I'm sure that progress will start real soon. But anyway, a good discussion from Donald.
Yeah, that'll start next April.
Well,
yeah, that'll start next April, April 25th or so.
By the way, when you work with batting practice, are you the pitcher, are you the fielder, or does Mama do the pitching?
No, this is a game tonight, and unfortunately my schedule has precluded me from being involved. They really aren't interested in having assistant coaches that make 2 out of 10 games, that kind of thing. but I coached fall ball last year, and I was the batting practice pitcher.
Very
boy,
good.
I can mow down 9-year-olds like nobody's business.
I take it you're more successful in the baseball side than you are the go-karting side? You're more helpful?
I understand. Yes, I am more helpful with baseball and basketball and football than I am at, say, fixing our quarter midget engine, which is our latest development. It went as, what does Shane say, Kesha? It went Kesha last night.
Yep.
So we're going to attempt to have that repaired before we race this weekend at Mini Indy.
Now, you've got a basketball game tomorrow night, and what is left for your Indianapolis 500 schedule? Because, I mean, as we're going to talk about here in a minute, I think this is kind of the last breath as we lead up to the Indy 500. I know Saturday's not track activity, but I really look at Wednesday each week as kind of the last real chance to get a breath before you go into an Indy 500. What does your schedule look like? Anything with regard to the race?
Tomorrow we're out at the track for some meetings for our Carb Day TV coverage and also a couple of quick radio meetings. I'm going to work on the radio broadcast for the 500 in the pits this year again. So a few things like that. And then Friday it's wall-to-wall. They're at 8 o'clock in the morning. We're on the air on the NBC Sports Network from 11 until 4. I mentioned this last night, but Dario Franchitti is going to be in the booth for the Firestone Indy Lights race, the Freedom 100, with Ari Jr., who will not be able to speak about the Bachelorette, but can talk about the Lights race, and Mike King will anchor that, and then our regular IndyCar crew will do the final practice from 11 to 12:15, and then we come back after the Lights race for the pit stop competition, and we go until 4. Then, obviously, we head to 96th Street Steak Burgers for the Burger Bash. And Saturday morning, I'm doing the parade. I'm the field reporter, the street reporter for the parade, which I honestly at this point don't know what time that starts. 11 a.m., noon?
Have you done
something
play?
Like that? I suppose I should.
Have you done play by
check
play?
Into that. And then I'm the field reporter. Bob Jenkins is the host, and I may have a message, but I don't know who is in the booth with Bob, but he will have a co-host with him in the booth. And I'll interview a few drivers, and I'll need to double-check my pronunciation of our pace car driver, Guy Fieri or Fieri. I'll talk to him and some of the other dignitaries like Kirk Hendricks and people like that. That airs, by the way, at 5 p.m. on Saturday afternoon on the NBC Sports Network, immediately followed by a new episode of IndyCar 36. I hear it's really good. J.R. Hildebrand, they followed him for qualifying. And obviously, one of the backstories for J.R. Hildebrand is going to be his return to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where he came within a quarter of winning the 500 as a rookie. And I mean, you know this. J.R. has handled this perfectly. He's answered the question, I think, literally 1,000 times since last May and has not ducked it. When I see him ask the same question multiple times the same day, he doesn't get frustrated and give a short answer. He answers it as honestly as he can and talks about it, and he doesn't need to be embarrassed about it, as we've talked about. He did what just about everybody else has done that's been out at the Speedway very much. He hit the wall. It happens. But that will be one of the stories, and that'll air at 6:30. And also, I'm hearing that the follow for IndyCar 36 this weekend is going to be Elio Castroneves, and I think he's got a great chance to win the 500 this year. We felt that way a couple of years ago that he was the guy to beat, but I think he's maybe lingering in the background a little bit more, as much as someone with that team that's won it 3 times can do. But I have not decided who I'm picking yet at this point, like that really matters. But he's got to be on the short list. I will not be surprised at all if Elio wins. And then Sunday morning, obviously, get out there early, work radio for the race, host a few people in the morning, and then we do have a post-race call-in show. I think
Well, that's not good. We've just lost him to a center fielder pitch. It's a good time to take a break. Anyway, when we come back, we'll have a. Hopefully, we'll have Kevin back from baseball land. We're going to talk a little John Lacy based off a conversation I had with Donald Davidson last night on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Doug Bowles is going to join us from Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And then an engineer going to join us about 7:40 to talk about the changes to the Dallara. This is Trackside with Kevin and Kevin on 1070 The Fan. Welcome back to Trackside. This is Kevin and Kevin, minus Kevin, although we have found him. He's hanging out in a baseball field on the west side. Kevin, are you back with us?
I got hit by a foul ball.
Well, you were in center field, so let me just brief you on the baseball language. If you're in center field, that wasn't a foul ball.
Well, I'm mobile. And my guy's up to bat now. My guy's up to bat now, so I'll be distracted.
Can you do play-by-play?
No, I'm not. I can't, but I'm not going to.
Oh,
I
see.
It will cost you.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can say ball one, ball two, ball. We have a lot of. It's difficult for the 9 and 10 year olds to throw strikes.
I tell you what, I've watched some major league games that are pretty difficult in that respect as well.
By the way, I think we're up probably 12-0, and I don't believe we have a hit yet. And that's pretty commonplace.
Where does young Jackson hit in the lineup?
It's throw him in a hat.
Oh, okay.
I think today he's hitting like sixth, and he just hit a deep fly ball to right field. Foul. Ooh, by inches.
Give it to him. By the way, where is he playing position-wise?
He's playing shortstop today, but our coach is great. He shakes it up, and everybody moves around.
I like that. Again, I can't believe that most of the current news on the show is coming from the Talk of Gasoline Alley, but a nice conversation. Donald told a story yesterday about John Lacy, and he was at the rookie luncheon, and you'll be pleased to know that Donald really considered him extremely outgoing, very polite, very professional, spoke with everyone at the table. Have you yet had any interaction with John?
None. We've interviewed him a couple of times on television, but it's always been someone else. I know Robin talked to him once, and Derek Daly talked to him once, so I have not had the chance to speak with him yet. But I've heard good things about him, too, and I've heard from some people that work with him on his team, and they say great things that he has. You know, and it's amazing. We've had this bias is the wrong word, but we've had this feel and this thought of what Formula One drivers are like. And let's run down the Formula One drivers that we've dealt with in the last few years. Takuma Sato, great to deal with. Great kid, great guy. Justin Wilson, nicest guy in the world. Rubens Barrichello might be able to battle him for nicest guy in the world. He's been great so far. You know, I wasn't around for Nigel Mansell other than
that was a little
I was
tricky.
Working at the radio station. But I'm sure it was. And I wasn't covering the series. I was just covering the 500 the years that he was here. So I can't speak to that. But, you know, in some ways I wonder if it's just they get used to what's expected of them, and not much from a media standpoint is expected of them. So when they're asked to do more, it takes them a moment to get used to it. But Barrichello from the beginning has done everything his team and his sponsors have asked him to do and does not grumble about it. He seems fine with everything he's asked to do.
I would agree with that. And then, of course, you've got Cheever. I'm not sure how we're going to rate that one just yet. Some days good, some days a little much. But, so anyway.
Yep, and he'll tell you what he thinks of your question.
Yep. So we had a nice conversation about that. Donald, he even broke news on his own show. I don't know if that's allowed or a first, but he broke news as well. So it was a banner show, and apparently I'm the difference maker there. So we might want to keep that in mind.
You're going to be there tonight, so have at it.
Anything you would like to ask Donald Davidson?
No, I sit with him every night. I'll ask him something when I have something to ask him. Yeah.
By the way, the included in the field in 93, we were on this discussion just a little bit earlier. Jim Crawford was also had some Formula One starts. Raul Boisel, Trying to remember. Teo Fabi, we were back and forth on whether or not he had starts before or after the Indy 500. And so I think there might have been one more, but quite an impressive list back to 1993. Do you have a sense yet of what your race day looks like? I mean, mine's wall-to-wall, and I think you started to tell that story as you went off the air. Maybe there was a little bit more about the evening programming.
Yeah, my race day is not too bad. It's in the morning. I think I'm hosting a small group that won a charity auction in the morning, and then I'm working radio for the race. So it's nice. I love working with the radio people. We don't do a lot of meetings. We just get down to business and react to what's happening. And it's a little bit more loose and relaxed, as much as the Indianapolis 500 can be. I love being on the grid for the pre-race ceremonies. It's going to be very emotional this year. It always is emotional, but when Weldon's car is on the track, that's going to be challenging, I think. And then after the race, we do a drive-home show, the Talk of Gasoline Alley, where we recap the race more. We'll get a few nostalgia questions in a little later on and mix them in, but we talk a lot about just what happened that day. We take phone calls. We'll have some people up in the media center come by and give us their thoughts on that as well. And then I was going to start to mention also, I've had a lot of questions about what's on overnight, the night before the race. The Saturday, did I get this on the air, what they're doing with the History of the 500 specials?
That was what I wanted to make sure you got on the air.
That got cut out?
Yeah.
Okay, they'll rerun that documentary, the 10-part documentary, the History of the 500, all day Saturday. I don't know exactly what time it starts. Check 1070thefan.com. And then the best of Talk of Gasoline Alley, some different, I don't know if it's different segments or if they've just picked out four shows or what, but that runs from midnight until 4 a.m. And then, as I understand it, from 4 until 5, some highlight packages of various 500s over the years. So, and then the stations come on starting at 5 a.m. on race day.
A quick thought about being up, excuse you, a quick thought about being up at the top of one of the turns. Is that unsettling? You're up on top of the grandstands often for these races. Tell us what that view is like, and is it a little unsettling when you first get up there?
I guess a little bit, yeah. Yeah, it's been two or three years since I've been up there. I guess a couple of years. I was up there for the Brickyard the year before last. You look behind you, and turn four, you're actually hanging over, I believe it's turn four, yeah, you're hanging over Georgetown Road. And turn two is the only other place I've been, and you're up pretty high, but neither are very daunting or very intimidating. It's just a cool place to be. You're up above the crowd. There's a nice breeze. The only challenge is that once you get up there, you're really not coming down, and you're there for 5 or 6 hours, so you have to plan your hydration accordingly, or lack thereof.
Yes.
But it's, you know, I'm always torn where I'd rather be. I love calling races from up high, but you miss being down in the action and down in the pits and on the grid for the pre-race ceremony. So I've always just told them, a few years ago I was given an option of where I wanted to be, and I said, you know, I'm happy either place. You just put me where you need me to be, and that'll be fine.
Well, we're going to let you go because I'd much rather you watch your son's baseball. And we're going to go to break, and when we come back, Doug Bowles, and we'll talk a little Dan Weldon, big spread coming in tomorrow's Indianapolis Star, and then we'll move into David Cripps, the engineer of Panther Racing, to help us explain the changes that made to the Dallara and looking ahead to J.R. Hildebrand's race. We'll catch you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock here on 1070. Enjoy the rest
That'll
of your
work.
Evening.
I'll see you then.
Okay.
Yep.
We'll come right
Thank
back
you.
With...
See you tomorrow.
We'll come back in just a minute with Doug Bowles from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. This is 1070 The Fan. Welcome back to Trackside with Kavin and Kevin, minus Kevin. He's off playing baseball tonight, so flying solo in the big chair. So we brought in Doug Bowles, number one vice president of communication, probably because you're the only one, but... Good day.
I'm glad I'm number one in somebody's book, maybe.
That's right. Let's talk a little Dan Weldon. You've got some plans for the weekend. We know about the sunglasses. We know about laps 26 and 98. There'll be. How would we describe that? It can't be a moment of silence when you've got cars speeding around the racetrack. How would we describe those two laps?
Well, I think the idea in those two laps, again, is just to celebrate Dan and for people to get up on their feet and have a reason to celebrate Dan in the middle of the race itself, just as if he were still competing. And we felt like the two race laps that made the most sense were the ones that had represented the numbers that he used when he won his two events. So I think that's really how we want it to be. We just want a way to connect him to this year's 500 as if he were still there trying to defend his win from last year.
He's profiled in a couple stories in tomorrow's Indianapolis Star, and then, of course, he's the reason or the celebration that we'll have at the Carb Night Burger Bash be a very uplifting and just so much a part of who we are and as both journalists and fans and Speedway officials. Tell us also about the whereabouts of the car, what you know about it in terms of, just where it goes this particular weekend, his winning car from last year.
Well, right now, it just literally came off the racetrack about 25 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago. We did an install lap with Brian Herta driving the car. They came in, made sure everything was okay, made a couple changes to the electronics, and Brian took it out and ran another lap in the car. We're just trying to get it set and ready to go. So it's the first time that car has been on track at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway since last May. And then the car was then rolling over to the museum. It'll be on display in the museum through Saturday, and then Sunday it'll roll back over into one of the MotoGP garages in preparation for use on race day. It'll actually run, if all goes well and things stay the same, it'll actually run right about the time back home again in Indiana is sung. So we're looking forward to that. Actually, I tweeted a couple photos, so if anybody wants to see those of the car actually on track today, it was actually a pretty cool sight. Brian wore an all-white helmet and all-white suit, and then we had an opportunity to talk to Brian and Sam Schmidt both afterwards. A pretty emotional conversation. Hopefully we'll have that up on the website here in the next 12 hours or so.
Doug Bowles joins us from the Speedway. Brian Herta is also going to wear a hat signed by or a helmet signed by all the drivers, and then the helmet is going to be auctioned off benefiting the Alzheimer's Association. You and I have had a chance to talk about Dan a little bit here in the last couple months. Give us a sense, maybe a story that really rings true that about who he is that maybe most of the people listening haven't seen. I mean, we've seen him in Victory Lane and the Milk on the Head and so forth, but you spent some time with him. What sense do you have?
Yeah, well, I got an opportunity to know Dan before he ever became an IndyCar driver when he was still running Indy Lights and he was looking for an IndyCar ride, and I was at Panther at the time, and we started following him. And actually, the first real conversation we had with him was at Gateway when we were running over there. In fact, I think Dan won the lights race that day, and ultimately he ended up running a couple races for us at Panther at the end of the 2002 season before he went to Andretti. So I got a chance to see him on the front end, and he was part of the fun of having Dan those two races. I used to take a bus to the racetracks with my wife and our family, and my stepson, Connor, spent a lot of time skateboarding in the paddocks, and Dan was always out playing with the boys, and really kind of, Connor's racing cars now, and Dan just really kind of adopted Connor and was always very, very good to Connor, and it wasn't just Connor. I mean, Dan adopted a lot of young race car drivers or guys that wanted to try that, so that was something cool about him. But I think maybe the thing that sticks out most to me, there's two. I had an interesting conversation with him at Vegas on the Friday night before the Vegas race that we kind of walked up and made fun of his hair because he'd gotten his hair cut off, and we talked about winning the 500, and he'd done a lot of things for us throughout the summer, and we started talking about family and his kids, and he'd never seen the photos of his kids on Victory or on the Yard of Brick, so we talked about getting those to him the following week, and obviously that didn't happen. But I think for me, there's a lot of peace in the fact that the conversation I had with him was not really about racing, but about what a family man he'd become and how much his kids and his wife had meant to him and how truly excited I think he was to sit down, a week later and maybe get a chance to look at those photos. So I think I'm happy that my last conversation with him was about his family.
Yeah, that's and my last conversation had to do with just needling me. That was another aspect of Dan that no one was free from the little jabs that he would give, and it was all in fun. He was always he always just kind of commanded the conversation. He just was in a very playful way. And I think the thing that you kind of touched on, we saw a transformation in him. I feel like we knew him his whole life because he made such a transformation from young, energetic, kind of a playboy race car driver to, and then he had the fall from Ganassi and the Andretti teams to being, you know, kind of humbled a little bit, and then kind of becoming the family guy. We just kind of saw it all in about a 6-year period, and I think that's what I feel like. I knew him most of his life.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that way, and even people that didn't get a chance to spend a lot of time with him, if they spent a little time with him, he had that ability to connect and make you feel like you really knew him and that you were special. And I think you're right. I mean, even we did see him change quite a bit from when he first started running in the IndyCar series to where he was in 2011 when he won his second championship. But that Dan Weldon, that fun-loving Dan Weldon, that engaging Dan Weldon was always there. And when you say he was humbled a little bit, I don't know if it was so much that he was humbled as much as I think he began to appreciate the position that he was in and understand that with that position some responsibility came with it. And I think he took that flag of being an Indy 500 champion and an advocate for our sport, and he waved that flag as hard as anybody could wave it. And I think a lot of his change had to do with, I think, a great amount of responsibility that he felt to tell the story of IndyCar racing and the Indianapolis 500.
We're going to shift gears, let you go, and we're going to move into David Cripps, who's going to be joining us in here. Thanks for just a few minutes with us, Doug. It's going to be a great weekend. I can't wait to really enjoy the race and to celebrate who Dan was. It was a special friend loss, certainly.
Absolutely, and good luck with the Burger Bash. I know everybody's pulling for that thing to be really successful.
Well, if we get together and we've got nice weather, it'll be successful regardless of, A, who shows up, and, B, how much good we do for people in the community. But thanks, Doug. We'll see you at the track again tomorrow. It seems like every day, but we'll see you tomorrow.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
We're going to transition now to David Cripps, Panther Racing engineer. I guess since we were just talking about Dan right there, let's bring the people into your observations of Dan how you had a chance to work with him.
Was that to me that comes?
Yeah, David. How are you? Nice to have you with us.
Good. Yeah, my experience of working with Dan, what a great guy. I mean, and, you know, for sure, you know, coming back this month, you know, it really brings back a lot of fond memories of Dan and how much he absolutely loved this place and, you know, obviously dearly missed.
You've had a lot of drivers at this racetrack. How was he in terms of just the technical side? He really seemed to know what he wanted from the race car at this particular track.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, this track, I mean, it was almost as if he knew every single individual piece of aggregate that was in the surface of that track, and boy, he wanted to make sure his setup worked for every single individual piece. I mean, he certainly seeked perfection at this track.
Now, we brought you on the show tonight to kind of give us a simple version, if there is such a thing, of the changes that IndyCar and Dallara made to the chassis finalized today. Give us a sense for how this changes things. And I guess first to start out with, were you concerned by the way the car lifted in the Carpenter and Charlie Kimball accidents?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to say that, yes, we were a little concerned by that. I mean, that was one of the things that we were really hoping that the new car was going to address. And, you know, it certainly seems that, you know, there's potentially a little bit of an issue there. Now, Dallara have made an update to the cars, or recommended an update that we've all gone ahead and done, which I think will be, you know, something that will help, you know, prevent that from happening. I think the one problem that we've always dealt with on the track is it's the sort of angle of impact, and it's how the cars vary, and you always basically end up with a sort of different trajectory that the cars have when they lose the grip. And, you know, like I say, we're certainly hoping that the modifications are going to prevent that.
David Cripps, lead engineer of Panther Racing, and I suppose we could say with DRR, Panther DRR as well. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. Panther DRR.
I got to make sure I get that right. I still want to say it's Dreyer Reinbold Racing, but I will endeavor to get it right. It took me about 3 years to get Andretti Green Racing out of my brain, but
and it exists within our team too as well. I can assure you, it's you know, and then we're it's all melding together very quickly, and we did have a relationship with them last year, so it's all sort of moving along quite seamless from that side of things. But it is it is always hard, obviously, to sort of get used to the different names.
So you made the changes to the race car, and as I understand it, you made the changes in-house, correct?
Yes. Well, you had the opportunity. It was either you sent some components to Dallara or you could do them yourself. It was basically a modification that was done to the support beam for the underwing, and that should help in preventing the car from lifting up.
And this is the part that this is why you're really good at it and why you get paid a lot of money. Explain how you changed it.
Basically, what's happened is there's been some modifications made to the beam where it's basically been a weaker point, a weakness has been created in that beam, so it will fail under that situation and then allow the underwing to, you don't want to say collapse, but it'll basically allow that to deform, so therefore it'll stop that flat surface from coming up against the ground.
I'm going to transition here to your driver just a minute. We talked about, Kevin was on location at his son's baseball game, but we had a chance just a little bit ago to talk about how much J.R. Hildebrand has really, I don't want to say embraced what happened last year, but he has stood up to it and said, look, I mean, this is, he's not buckled, he's not gotten frustrated, he's with the questions that have been asked.
Sure.
How proud of you, how proud of him are you for the way he's handled everything after turn four last year?
Oh, I mean, you know, absolutely. I mean, that was, you know, it's easy to turn around and you know, say, well, that's just racing, you know, when we have a crash here and there and you have different incidents or you qualify poorly, but you know, obviously that was a little larger than you would normally expect to deal. And, you know, I mean, he's done a great job at handling that. And, boy, talk about how to temper a rookie quickly. And, you know, we turned him into a veteran, you know, in sort of one foul swoop in a way. But, no, very proud. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we're going to have an opportunity to use all of that strength and knowledge and go out there and get it done this Sunday.
The jump from year one to year two, I see much more relaxed in himself. Is he a different driver in year two?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always a slightly different driver, just as you're a slightly different engineer as the years go by. I mean, things change, and you know, I think we all tend to learn things in life as we go along. Certainly in this business, as fluid as everything is, so you certainly have to always be learning. And it's nice to have got a lot of the basics out of the way. I mean, that's always the nicest thing. Once you've got that first year out of the way and you understand all the different personalities that are involved and all the different needs, and you know, you don't have to anticipate or try and explain things. You really understand how it unfolds and how the week unfolds. And you know, it's been, you know, really great to get back there second year, and looking forward to a lot more than just the second year, that's for sure.
You've got Panther Racing has had four straight second place finishes. Do you look at that like, you know, pat on the back to ourselves if when you step away from it and say, you know, four straight, that's quite a remarkable accomplishment, or do you say there are four that got away?
Well, I mean, I guess you could look at it, you know, yeah, it's four that got away, or but I mean, just to finish the Indianapolis 500, you know, is an accomplishment. So I think it's a true testament to the whole Panther Racing organization, you know, and how hard they work towards that. And it's, you know, it's the mechanics, it's everybody involved that put together a reliable, fast car. And it's, I don't think you can single out any individual. That would be very unfair. I think it just goes to show that it's a track that Panther Racing has a lot of passion for, and we put a lot of effort in, and, you know, and hopefully we can sort of get that one last place that's been elusive to us in the last 4 years.
Well, let's hope so. David Cripps, elite engineer with Panther Racing and Panther DRR, two great drivers, J.R. Hildebrand and Oriel Servia. Best of luck, David. I hope it's a good weekend for you and the whole team. You got a good crew, as you mentioned, and I certainly understand that. And see you in Victory Lane.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kev.
That's David Cripps, Trackside with Cavan and Kevin. We'll be right back to go through a few Twitter comments, and we'll wrap up the show. Welcome back to the final segment of Trackside with Cavan and Kevin, a terrific night of racing talk coming up. Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson comes up after this show. And then Mark Monteith's one-on-one segment with Sam Schmidt, which is very entertaining. I heard part of that earlier. Let's go through some Twitter questions, and this is where I get to see how difficult it is for Kevin to read the name of the person along with the question and scroll through while continuing to talk. This is why he's a pro, and I'm a typist. Let's go to, it says, at Aaron M. 1978, I'm sure that's his birth year, mentions, we were talking earlier about Formula One drivers in the 1993 field, Danny Sullivan. He adds to the list. Donald Davidson reminds me that he ran the 1983 Formula One season, and Donald also pointed out during the break that Teo Fabi had not yet been a Formula One driver at the time of the 93 race. Chad Smith, which is at IndyCar Chad, says his preview of the 500 is up at openwheelamerica.com. But the really key part of this discussion, and I think we'll need to carry this over to tomorrow, it's something to chew on. I think he raises an interesting question, is if you were going into this race, do you take a Penske car, an Andretti car, or the field? And I think that's a good one. I think you'd be inclined based off not just history, but recent history, you'd want to take the Penske. But I'm telling you, those Andretti's looked awful good. I would probably take, I'm going to probably take the field in this one, although that's kind of a risky proposition when you're against the Penske's. At S2000 Moose, I like that, underscore Moose, what would you rate the percentage chance of a Chevy losing on Sunday? 30% less? Well, I think less. I think it's probably a Chevy, but it certainly could happen the other way. There's also some questions, several here, because I ran a list, by the way, of Carb Night Burger Bash details. It's at IndyStar.com. It includes some of the things we're going to auction off. It does not include the particulars in terms of who might be attending. I don't give that information away because drivers may or may not be able to show up for things beyond their control. But, again, we've got the talk of Gasoline Alley coming up. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's been a wonderful night. A little choppy with Kevin in baseball and me sitting in his chair, but we'll figure it out. We'll move forward through the rest of the weekend. This is 1070 The Fan, and next up, the talk of Gasoline Alley.